Wednesday night edition of the pod. Lots more to get to here. We got the Wendell Carter Jr. scouting report and, coincidentally, the offseason preview of a team that is selecting right in the range where Carter is selected to go, the Chicago Bulls. Why don't we change it up this time? Let's go with the Bulls first, just to keep things interesting, starting with, of course, their salary cap situation as we head into this offseason.
So the Bulls have, like, kind of, if you want to think about it as max space, they have about $26 million. That would keep the holds for Zach LaVine and David Nwaba, both of whom they could very well retain. They would lose Sean Kilpatrick and Paul Zipser, both of whom are non-guaranteed at this point. So if they keep those guys, then it goes down to about 23. But, you know, it's a pretty good idea of where they are. And that should also be considered against the backdrop. We talked about this a little bit with the Kings on yesterday's show, that Chicago could have an absolute ton of cap space in 2019 without counting LaVine at all, which I expect that we will eventually. They could have as much as $70 million in space in 2019. So again, that might be just so much money where they can just feel like they can spend into that a fair amount. But what's different between Chicago and Sacramento is that not only do the Bulls, you know, if they roll that cap space on like a trading for a multi-year guy, but LaVine goes on top of that because the expectation is that he will get paid more than his cap hold, which is $9.6 million.
Yeah, of course, they have the 7th overall pick, also the 22nd overall pick, which they got in the Omer Asik, Nikola Mirotic trade. It's been largely assumed, especially once that Asik trade was made. You'll remember they took on the bad money for him. He's due $11.3 million this year and then has a $3 million guarantee for next year. And the thought was, well, all right, they just reduced their 2018 cap space by $11.3 million. This clearly shows that they're not really that interested in getting into the restricted free agent game or the free agent game. There have been some rumblings. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Woj remarked at one point that maybe the Bulls could be a sneaky free agency contender. And you definitely don't just totally sit it out in terms of free agency or limit yourself to one-year deals. I think their strategy should be, you know, they're not ready to contend next year, even for the playoffs, almost certainly no matter who they get. So with that being the case, you just try to see if you can get someone on a good value contract. I mean, this offseason is an opportunity for the teams who do have cap space, and maybe see if going forward you can get someone who's on a good value deal, or you again go the take on bad contracts route. We talked about that dilemma some with the Kings, although the Bulls don't have quite as many young players, I think, with actual potential as the Kings do. Maybe you could say that their core guys have more, but it's and Chicago probably considered more of a free agent destination than Sacramento overall as well. But yeah, I think it'd be really interesting of whether they decide to go the cap space route, whether they decide to go the restricted free agent route, or whether they decide to go the take on bad contracts.
And a lot of that will depend on the offers that are out there. And a lot of that will depend on whether Chicago is willing to take on 2019 money, just because I feel like for the sake of completeness, we should mention it. Theoretically, thanks to the structure of his contract, the Bulls could actually stretch Omer Asik's remaining $14 million over 5 years if they really needed to clear that extra $8 million or so in space. I don't expect that to happen, but if theoretically the circumstance presented itself and the right offer was there, they could do that and spread that 14 over five. So more likely, though, it'll be just that $3 million partial guarantee for next year, and they can either eat that or stretch it depending on how much space they need. And something that I wanted to talk about with Chicago, we did this a little bit with Sacramento, but it's a worthwhile exercise for these type of teams, is the Bulls weren't good this year. You know, I think it's going to take them a little while to build this up. So then you can kind of think about their roster in terms of what players that they have already are like likely starters, likely rotation players, and to run through the players they have on rookie scale contracts right now. Lowry Markkanen, last year's lottery pick.
So we can just check them off here. So Markkanen certainly showed enough to me to be considered a starter of the future at a minimum.
Yeah, I would say so as well. As the four, right. I don't think he has enough defense to be the five, but certainly value. Chris Dunn, certainly better this past year than I expected, but I see him more as a, you know, like a high rotation player, but not a starter personally.
Yeah, I mean, worth remembering that for all the improvement he showed, still below a 50% true shooting, and he's this next year he's going to be 25 already, because remember how old he was when he was drafted. And if you're interested in this, by the way, we did, of course, a couple of months ago as the season was wrapping up, kind of reviews of the seasons for all these young players. So if you want a little bit more background on why it is where we're talking about the Kings, the Bulls, or any other team, you know, right towards the end of the regular season, we discuss these players' seasons and why it is that we believe they're part of the future or not necessarily. So, to Dunn, and you know, there are point guards, Colin Sexton, Trae Young, who could be available in their range at seven, and I'm not so impressed by Dunn that if I felt like one of those point guards was the guy, that I wouldn't select that guy instead.
Next up's probably Bobby Portis, has one more year before restricted free agency. I think he can be a rotation player. Defense is a big concern, but he can put the ball in the bucket. So I get for him, it would be if you can get him back at a reasonable price, sure, you could play him, but I wouldn't be obsessed with that idea.
Yeah, and since we drafted 22nd, we'll have a low cap hold next year, plays the same position as Lauri Markkanen. Seems unlikely that they would agree on an extension with him. That's usually something we talk about on these, unless it were really just a pretty team friendly one, which, you know, I kind of doubt, especially Portis with the way that he shot the ball and scored. You know, he might believe that he's a future starter. I don't know that the team should see him that way. Zach LaVine,
I still think he's more of a backup than a starter, personally. I think that's the better niche for him, especially considering LaVine sucks at defense, and offensively he's never been efficient. And sure, there's some weight on all of his stuff from those early years where he was really out of place in Minnesota, but he wasn't, and last year he was dealing with an injury, so I think you could discount a fair portion of that. But I just don't see it with him all the way. I think he will get paid like a low-end starter, if not stronger than that. But
yeah, I mean, there's talk that
I don't
see
him
could be the number two restricted free agent on the market. I forget who it was who was floating that idea that, you know, he could potentially,
oh my God,
get a max offer. And that seems completely insane to me, as we've talked about. You know, if I had to pay him $15 million a year for the next 4 years, I might swallow hard and do it just on the hope that, all right, he's just going to be that good of a scorer. But especially coming off the knee injury, then the fact that he got shut down again, granted they were tanking, but granted that they were double granted there, that he probably would have helped the tank the way he was playing at the time, but he had some tendonitis and that surgically repaired knee, and oh, it was nothing serious, but you know, never the greatest sign there.
I would not pay him $15 million. If that's on the table, if it were solely my decision, I'd let him walk.
But how do you think
I think the Bulls would match. Absolutely.
I mean, let's remember, now the fact that Markkanen looks as good as he has maybe makes it a little bit more palatable politically if, you know, Dunn and LaVine don't end up being like these cornerstone pieces. But I mean, what do you think the Bulls would be willing to pay?
17, 18. And I think that would be.
I could see it even getting as high as 20. To be honest, I think it could settle.
And then, so I want you often ask me this question, but I think this is a good one to ask you. What offer would you make Zach LaVine right now to make it so that he doesn't go through restricted free agency?
Well, would I make? I mean, it's just this is one of those times where our opinion, in terms of actually just trying to predict what's going to happen. And for Jabari Parker, your opinion is different than mine. You know, I think I see him. Another guy who's a similar kind of player to LaVine in terms of his ability to create shots, injury history, absolutely zero defense whatsoever, except for the third quarter of game four against the Celtics. But it's almost just for what my approach would be, it's just like, it's not even an interesting question. I mean, for me, I would probably offer him like $12 million or something, you know, just the idea of, hey, you know, even if he just ends up being like a great bench scorer for us, you know, which is kind of what I foresee his destiny as being, that because he's so bad defensively, and then, you know, maybe he has some upside to become good enough to be a starting shooting guard because he's just so explosive as a scorer, you know. But I'm definitely, to me, especially after the injury history, like, you got to give yourself some good upside on top of that contract, which I think at $12 million he would have. But that's, again, that's just not realistic. Like, I think, what will their starting offer be? You know, I think their starting offer would be $17 million a year. And I think it's going to settle at 19.5 or 20. I think that's where it's going to end up. I think that's going to be insane. I think we're going to give them a bad grade for their offseason, in part because of that. Well, we'll see what else they do, obviously. But that is what I foresee happening. And then that obviously is going to cut into that 2019 summer space as well, in theory. But yeah, I'm just we didn't know whether he's a winning player or not. And then he suffered the injury too. I mean, it's the combination of those two things. And I'm not as much of a believer in his upside as a scorer as I am with someone like Parker, just because of Parker's superior size, superior passing to me, superior skill level, although Levine is a good shooter. He's not like the greatest skill level outside of that.
We can go briefly through their other young guys. Vonleh, restricted free agent. I don't see him as a part of the key part of their future if he got, you know,
well,
maybe
well, a price. And Vonleh is interesting here because his cap hold is so big, right? At 10.5 million. And his qualifying offer is only four. I think if I'm him, you know, it remains to be seen. I mean, he has some skills. I think he can help some teams defensively as a switch guy, as kind of a change of pace backup center. Playing him at power forward, it doesn't really work. He's just that shooting has never really developed. But as a rebounder, as a switch guy defensively, and then maybe, you know, his stretch ability starts to look a little bit better. He's really can't do much offensively other than, in theory, shoot it at some point. But giving him that qualifying offer makes it tough because now he's taking up 10.5 million of your cap space. And so whether you want to take on a bad contract, whether you want to make some other moves, make a restricted free agency offer, whatever it is, you probably end up having to renounce him at that point. So he's a guy who I think might be pretty gettable. And it wouldn't even shock me if they don't give him a qualifying offer. They might, well, just, I mean, because they still have Cristiano Felicio, obviously, who they better hope can bounce back given his contract. They've got Robin Lopez. They've got Markkanen and Portis. Like, they have a lot of bigs on this team already under contract. And so I don't know that it would make sense for these guys to pay even a one-year $4 million contract to Vonleh. And Vonleh could say, hey, you know what? My market isn't there. $4 million, sure, sign me up. So it wouldn't – I think probably greater than 50% chance he doesn't get the qualifying offer, if only because of that large cap hold, in addition to the thought that, oh, he might be able to take it. And remember, you can still withdraw the qualifying offer up until – I forget exactly when it is. I think it's July 23rd now under the CBA that you can withdraw it. After that, you can't. Call that the Dion Waiters rule. So we didn't need to spend that much time on it, but I think that's an interesting one. I could very easily see him becoming an unrestricted free agent, maybe not right at the beginning, but later on in the process.
And you talked about qualifying offers. I think that's a good way of going into David Nwaba. So Nwaba had a solid year. He exceeded my expectations, but because they claimed him off waivers and have him now as a restricted free agent, his cap hold is only, you know, 1.7 million. So it's a lot more palatable to keep Nwaba around. Maybe if another team makes a strong offer for some reason, you let him go. But I think they can expect to bring him back, and they have early bird rights, so it's not a big deal. They can just kind of keep his hold on the books and just see what happens.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. I think they also just don't have any threes on this roster other than him, and he's even a little undersized for that, but he at least is intense, can defend. A guy that I like, certainly he can't shoot at all, but he has enough ball handling skills that he can kind of attack a mild closeout. He gets out in transition, and I thought that he really changed their defense a lot because they just didn't have anyone else who could guard it all on the wing. And then really beyond that, I don't think we need to discuss any of the other guys on this team as of this time.
The only one I want to say briefly is I don't love Denzel Valentine, but if they do and they're keeping Zach LaVine, then maybe that affects the way they think about the two guard spot. Though I don't feel like those guys preclude you from taking somebody who's talented. Though I don't, off the top of my head, I can't think of any two guards at like seven that they would take. Or, I mean, I guess the restricted market, or sorry, the unrestricted market actually has some interesting twos, but I wouldn't expect the Bulls to be in that business anyway.
Yeah, that does seem unlikely. I mean, you could see them if they. It was said by John Paxson that, oh, we never want to go through this again, in terms like alluding to how hard they tanked last year. So maybe they'll at least just try to get guys on 1 year deals at a minimum, and could be an option for a guy who wants to just sign a big contract, maybe get traded and then get back onto the market next year. Like, that's not totally unlikely. All right, we got more to talk about on these guys, but first, this from stamps.com, a service that Danny, you have used extensively in the last year or so.
I have. I did not grow up using the post office a ton. You know, I was a little bit too young for the really people who wrote a lot of letters and all that. So I was obviously familiar with how it worked, but I hadn't been dealing with a lot. And so when I had a book, physical copies that I had to get out to friends and family and everything else like that, I'm like, okay, well, let's see if there's a better way to do this than what I had been familiar with, and was really impressed with stamps.com, because whether you're looking at it from a convenience perspective or a cost-saving perspective, it really checks both those boxes. You can print your postage yourself. They send you a scale so you can weigh it and get everything exactly right, which is awesome. You can schedule pickups. And then from the cost savings perspective too. So you really get both those things. And that's what you're looking for basically any company that you're engaging with. And I was very impressed with stamps.com. I'm thankful that I don't have as much of that to do right now, but I'm really happy that they were around because they made that so much easier for me.
Yeah, with stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage, any letter, any package, any class of mail, all using your own computer and printer. Click, print, mail, and you're done. You don't have to lease a postage meter. No long-term commitments if you own a small business like we do. It's a great resource. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer, including a four-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale. You know how to do it. This is a Dunkdown ad. Use that cap space code on Stamps.com. You click on that microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in that cap space code. We've, of course, been talking about that extensively here with the Bulls. That's Stamps.com. Enter code CAPSPACE and let them know that you came from us. What else do we have to talk about with these guys?
So they're in a challenging place. So we talked about where their space is because of the timing of this all. So if they want to try to use their space to get somebody via trade, usually that happens in the early part of free agency. And they'll know what those offers are. And then they will materially change, for better or for worse, depending on supply and demand, by, let's say, the end of the first week. Because at that point, a lot of teams will have used their space. It just depends on where things are. That is right around when they would have to make a decision about whether they want to go after any restricted free agents. Like, I could actually see them as a Jokic offer sheet destination just because he's so good that, okay, let's give it 4 days, you know, the depending on how the Nuggets want to play it. Like, do they really want to tap the space for 5 days or 7 days, Otto Porter style?
Yeah, well, but the hilarity, Danny, the potential hilarity of them trying to get a restricted free agent at the same time as Zach LaVine is also getting a restricted free agent offer sheet. And so the potential that they would have to match that LaVine offer sheet before they could get their own restricted free agent, like if the LaVine offer sheet is like, you know, 10 hours before their offer sheet comes through, for example, like, and they wouldn't have, because obviously once they match on LaVine, his number goes up from his $9.6 million cap hold up to whatever the new number is. And that could potentially extinguish whatever space they needed with the restricted free agent offer sheet. So they just might just like not be able to make one once LaVine gets an offer sheet. Like that would be really funny if that happened. The odds on that are lower, but it's still something that could be an issue.
I hadn't even thought about that. That's completely crazy, but you're right. And then, and so with Chicago, just because they're so far from being competitive for me, I focus more on their potential targets as being younger guys. So if they don't love Chris Dunn, maybe they try to see what Dante Exum's market is. I mean, Exum is intriguing. He could, you know, potentially defend both guard positions. And so if they are committed to Zach LaVine, then that actually makes some sense there. Though I don't really love either of those guys being the offensive generators of shots for other guys. Maybe they could go after Seth Curry, kind of on a similar thing. But I think Curry more is, if they could get him at the price of a high-end rotation guard rather than as a starter, that'd be interesting. And then I don't know why I thought about Derek Favors there, but I kind of like the idea of Favors and Markkanen together. I think that could kind of work. And
yeah, they already have Robin Lopez, though.
Well, the idea would be that Robin Lopez is a temporary thing. And so if you could get Derek Favors, because one of the elements that is important to talk about with the summer is if you have cap space, there is a very real chance that you can get a better value this summer than you can. So if you can get Derek Favors at a price that you're happy with, probably for a 3 or 4 year deal, well, then, yeah, sure, you have a little bit of overlap for this year. Maybe you could find a taker for Robin Lopez. Probably not. But then you have him. You have that locked up. You know, if you can get him for $10 million or less, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah, so that seems unlikely. Interested I would imagine that Utah would be offering him more than that, although I don't know about the duration.
Well, and I don't know, you know, let's say if the money is similar, whether he would rather play in Utah or in Chicago, if he can be, you know, whether he wants to be a 4 next to Rudy Gobert, whether he'd rather be a 5 next to Markkanen. I don't know. I know that Favors has often thought of himself as a 4. So maybe he'd like that way, but we'll see. So yeah, I'm interested with all these teams, with the Kings, with the Hawks, with the Bulls, like how they approach this part of it, because this is a year where supply might actually exceed demand in terms of non-max players. So do they game that out, but also, you know, are the other teams desperate enough? So I think a couple of teams are going to go one path, a couple are going to go another, and we genuinely don't know right now which one of those is better, because it's going to be very context dependent.
And for Chicago, with Markkanen already in the fold and their belief in him seems to make the chances of an offer sheet for Chicago native Jabari Parker a little bit lower than you would have thought. I don't really like the idea of Parker and Markkanen playing together. That would be a pretty flammable defensive front court. Markkanen, not really a rim protector, can move his feet and switch a little bit, and maybe you would just be switching everything at that point defensively, but I'm not sure that that's the right option.
Can you imagine a starting five with Markkanen, Jabari Parker, and Zach LaVine?
Yeah, I don't like the Parker-LaVine fit very much. That's for sure. But I mean, you know, that could end up being a pretty good offensive team if everyone develops. But yeah, I mean, they would just be so flammable. Aaron Gordon, same kind of issues. I mean, the fact that the restricted free agents that are the sexiest and youngest play the same position as Markkanen makes it a little difficult. We've seen that Aaron Gordon really playing him at the three, although even if you have the shooting of Markkanen at the four, probably not the greatest idea still. So it doesn't seem like they really would be at the top of the restricted free agent market. And you mentioned Exum as a possibility. I think that too. But maybe now is the time to discuss what they should do in the draft. You know, we haven't watched all these guys yet. We're going to do Wendell Carter in just a bit here. But I mean, they're being right now on Draft Express, they're being mocked as selecting Trae Young at number 7 and Michael Porter, who has been working out in Chicago. Interestingly, Porter was examined by the Bulls doctors, and then those are going to be shared with all the other teams. Mark Borrelstein, Porter's agent, has long been thick as thieves with the Bulls, as well as many other organizations as well. Borrelstein does a great job. But if they're in a situation where they could choose between Trae Young and Michael Porter at number 7, in some ways, because Young is considered risky, Porter is obviously considered risky with the injury history, but I like those guys probably more, at least in terms of upside, than some of the guys above them. But it's kind of like once you're at 7, you've got a little bit more of a blank check in terms of, all right, we can take a risk here, as opposed to teams that are drafting higher. So I actually kind of like their position, and it's looking like pretty likely that at least one of those two guys, Carter and Young, will be available. And I think I'd be very happy to select either of those guys at 7, you know, assuming that the medicals check out in Porter, which we don't know yet.
Well, and at 7, if you assume that Ayton and Doncic are gone, if both Porter and Trae Young were gone, that means that Bamba, Jaren Jackson, or Marvin Bagley's around. So I mean, you're going to be getting somebody who's interesting. And with the Bulls, like we talked about with the Kings, not having a lot that's really set on your roster can be advantageous, because then you just take the player you think is best and you work it out from there. And so if they end up with a center, awesome. You know, then you hope that player and Markkanen are your front court for the long term. You can devote your resources, whether that be the 22 pick, cap space, future picks, all that kind of stuff, more towards the perimeter. And if it's Trae Young or Porter, then you go in other directions. And so I think they're in a really good place for that. It certainly would be better, just because having like the 5th pick is better than having the 7th pick, because you get more options. I think that they will end up with somebody who is worthwhile. It's just that we don't know who that is at the moment.
Man, Trae Young, Lauri Markkanen, drag screens, transition could be very, very difficult to guard, unless you're switching. That could be really tough. So yeah, I mean, I think we haven't fully finalized our boards yet, but you can kind of get a little bit of an idea of how I'm beginning to think about things so far. Let's see here. Anyone else that they might go after? Think about their team needs. They desperately need a 3, right? I mean, that's really the thing that they just don't have on this team right now. Any kind of like 3-and-D wing.
The problem, of course, being that at this point, you know, the ones that are available that are actually good are older and don't really make sense with the Bulls' timelines. And then the other ones are, you know, not nearly as good. So, I mean, maybe they just hope that Nwaba becomes that guy.
Yeah.
I
don't think he's ever going to learn to shoot well enough. You never know. Sometimes guys surprise you. But like the fact that he just like won't even take them at this point in his career is not a good
thing. Yeah. And especially if LaVine is coming back for Chicago, it is more important to get somebody who is definitely small forward sized, not kind of one of those fringy guys, because LaVine's already going to have trouble switching if they want to go to that. So, I mean, it's tough. I don't think they're going to go after Doug McDermott, considering everything that happened, considering they traded him away. They didn't have to. And yeah, I mean, they could be in the mix for all those kind of like James Ennis, Joe Harris types if they want to. My expectation for the Bulls has long been that they will use their space in one big move, you know, like with taking on a bunch of money and then whatever scraps remain, they can go after, do whatever. And that doesn't make sense to use for a small forward this year. because almost anybody they would be offering like that 20 type million to would be a pretty significant overpay.
Yeah, that seems right to me. If they're not, there's no restricted free agent that I would want to offer that type of a yearly salary to if I'm them, you know, because I think I probably like Markkanen. I'm not sure whether I like Aaron Gordon or Markkanen better, but you have Markkanen at a cheap price, so you probably want to put your resources elsewhere. Parker, especially for this team, I don't think it makes that much sense. You mentioned the issues with his fit with Lean. I do think that with the shooting that Markkanen has at the four, especially if you draft Trae Young, and then you've got Young, Zach LaVine, Markkanen, those guys are all really good shooters for their positions. So you might be able to get away with, if not Nwaba, you know, a guy like a James Ennis or a Luke Mbamute, who really is just much more of a defensive specialist at the three, and really just focus in on that just at that one position. Yeah.
And it's hard for the Bulls also, because like you could think of them as an interesting kind of bidder for somebody like Montrezl Harrell, just as a more of a backup fight, but they already have Cristiano Felicio at a bunch of money, and you're committing to a player like that, or even Julius Randle.
Yeah, you know, Randle,
on a multi-year thing.
Randle to me would be very, very interesting, because with Markkanen, fantastic fit there offensively. That would be, that combination in the front court would be extremely difficult to stop. And then Markkanen isn't an unbelievable switch guy, but he showed pretty good quick feet. Randle was a pretty good switch guy. I mean, you're going to have zero rim protection on that team, but hopefully you can deny penetration enough. And, you know, now if you're trying to switch everything with Trae Young and Zach LaVine, you know, that doesn't work quite as well. But he's someone I really would consider. Could this be...
Well, yeah. Also, a Trae Young, Julius Randle pick and roll with Markkanen on the far side.
Right.
Would be nasty, because if you switch it, then Julius Randle is going to beat the ever-loving crap out of the other guy. And if you try to go under, then Trae Young can shoot. Like, yeah, I think that Young would make Randle a much more interesting proposition. And I think that because the Bulls have their own first-round picks moving forward, you know, if it doesn't work out, you can just draft another center. Or they could take, maybe there's a high upside guy at 22. Like, I think that they can, you know, they can kind of throw lottery tickets then at the front court. They don't have to use their main resources on it.
What about them as a, they haven't really been talked about this way, but what about them as a Clint Capella destiny?
I mean, it's possible. I would actually, and maybe I've talked about the Capella versus Jokic stuff before, but I don't think they're in the right place for Capella right now, and Jokic would just be such a fundamentally transformative piece for them.
He's only 24, Capella, and again, his fit with Markkanen would be outstanding.
That's true. Yeah, if they still have the money left at that point, I could see that as a worthwhile engagement.
And likely it ends up being just more of a troll offer anyway.
Well, and especially if they get Michael Porter or somebody like that. Yeah, because, and remember, with the centers, if let's say they don't draft one, if they don't get a center, they're probably not going to be good next year anyway. They can just either draft or sign one the next year. Like, it's a worthwhile investment for them, because it's not just a troll offer sheet. They could actually use them. It could go either way is palatable for Chicago.
Yeah. Now, of course, if you do get a player like that now, and you've re-signed LaVine for $20 million a year, now you're basically down to $20 million in 2019 cap space. You don't even have max room in 2019, most likely. Robin Lopez, go ahead, sorry.
I was going to say the answer there is to just not sign Zach LaVine for that much money, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Robin Lopez could be a trade candidate here with 1 year left on his contract, $14 million. You know, he's so reasonably paid. I think we actually, in a mailbag question, once called him the most reasonably paid guy in the league, because he basically was traded for that exact reason in the Derrick Rose trade. Still, though, the center market's so flooded in terms of both free agents, it seems like maybe it's more likely that he gets moved. I don't think that there's a way that you get a first round pick for him trading him this summer. I'm sure they would love to make that trade if they could. I don't see a team that
needs there him. Is if you take back bad money.
Right.
Like,
yes.
That's the way that it could happen, is if you take somebody who makes like $10 million and sucks, then sure, I could maybe see that happening.
Well, so for that type of a construction, maybe you could see Lopez making a return to Portland, and they get back Chicago native Evan Turner, who actually could probably help this team. He's that sort of non-shooting, decent defensive three that I was talking about, if they have enough shooting at the other positions. And then you trade Lopez, that helps out the Blazers. They're obviously very familiar with his game. Then they don't have to re-sign Yusuf Nurkic if his price tag ends up being too high. So that actually would be a pretty interesting one. And the Blazers would save a bunch of money by not having to pay Nurkic. and still having Lopez in the fold for one more year, and then hopefully Zach Collins could take over for them. That would be a very interesting trade conception there.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with that idea, should Portland go that direction.
Yeah, what do the Blazers have, like number 20 or something this year?
They have 24.
Yeah, would you do that if you were the Bulls? That's tough, though. That I don't know if...
I don't think that's enough. That's because Evan Turner, so his remaining money, that's $36.5 million, and $18.6 of that is for next season, for 2019-20. So then that's a lot to give away. Maybe later in the process, if you kind of know, like maybe if it looks like you're going the LaVine Randall route, maybe at that point you do it. So it's like, hey, we're not going to have as much space to use anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there is a big,
it's like maybe make that deal on July 10th or July 14th, as opposed to doing it on July 1st.
Yeah. Yeah. So that kind of conception, I mean, that is tough, but that's, now the Bulls made that trade with New Orleans, probably never believing that would end up being as bad of a pick as 22, you know, giving up Mirotić, taking back Ashik,
right.
and Turner is even...
Cousins had just gotten hurt.
Yeah, and Turner is even, you know, really worse money than Ashik, although he can at least play. I mean, that's part of the thought here is, like, he could at least be, like, our starting three because we'll just have so much shooting outside of him. But I'm, yeah, that might not be quite enough for my money. But, you know, at some point you have to, I mean, how you want to use that resource, whether it's trying to get guys on good contracts that won't be available in later years because there'll be more cap space around the league, whether it's just holding on to it and maybe trying to make a play at the trade deadline to take on bad money when, you know, it's not as unpalatable to do that, whether it's just taking on bad money now. But yeah, to take on one of those pretty toxic, you know, $16 to $20 million contracts from the summer of 2016 that have 2 years left on it, I don't know that a first round pick in the 20s is good enough. And then you're also throwing in Lopez as well, who presumably has some kind of positive value. It may turn out that is the best they can do with that money. But I think if that's the offer, I probably would just keep the flexibility open still, or just try to get guys who could be helpful for us going forward on cheap contracts to be a starter. Anything else we got to talk about with these guys?
Not really. I mean, technically, Portis, Grant, Payne are all extension eligible, and Robin Lopez is as well, but I wouldn't expect any of those to actually happen.
All right, we'll get to Wendell Carter here, but first, this from Sonos. Right now for Father's Day, you can get a 15% discount on Sonos. That's actually better than it's been previously. They have this Father's Day special right now where you can create a custom Spotify playlist and send it to dad. You select your favorite artist in the year you're born, and then you do the same for your dad, and Spotify will generate a perfect playlist to bridge the generation gap at that fathersday.sonos.com URL to get 15% off when you create your playlist. And why do you want Sonos? Well, first of all, the home theater has been awesome. We've really now, especially with the playoffs being over, have been enjoying a lot of movies, a lot of shows. I'm actually going to watch The Expanse tonight. Looking forward to that after we're done recording. That's one of my favorite shows. That'll be awesome on that new. We got the Play Bar and their sub set up. And then we also have the Sonos One in a couple of rooms, and that you can actually control the music with your voice. The other awesome thing about Sonos is it's super easy for anyone who comes over. If they want to play their music, they can get onto there extremely easily with the Sonos app. We had a friend come over who's an awesome DJ a couple nights ago, and so she just went right into our Sonos and started playing her fantastic selection of music when we were all hanging out together. So it really is a fantastic system that is the easiest way to get entertainment at home. Once again, that URL, fathersday.sonos.com, that gets you that 15% off code when you create a custom Spotify playlist. The playlist generator expires June 17th, and terms and conditions apply. So Wendell Carter, let's just start with his physical profile, because he seemed, when he was going up through the ranks, as even a couple years ago, as a power forward prospect, I've been comparing him to Derek Favors since I first saw him a couple of years ago. But it really looks like now, especially the way the game is going, that he's going to be a center in the NBA.
Yeah, it does. And so that means you're comparing him differently. There's certain elements of Carter's game that look a lot better when you're comparing him to centers. But the part where I want to start with him, and I think of Carter as just the way we're doing the ordering, not necessarily due to evaluating him as a prospect, as the jumping off point for thinking about centers in a broader way. And so when I was looking at him and watching a little bit, I've started with Jaren Jackson and Mo Bamba. The idea that when we did the center rankings back in February, we talked about how really there was a group of about 15 centers And remember that there are guys who we didn't classify as centers who play center for a lot of reasons. Draymond Green is prominent among them, but there are a lot of other guys too. Anthony Davis, numerous others. So what we kind of agreed on at that point, and it was clarifying, was, you know, guys in that top group, you can pay them. They're, yeah, and one threshold could be whether they can play in the playoffs. You could go through a lot of different things. But then every other guy, there are a lot of players who provide value that are useful to have on your team, that are good to have, but that they're... The marginal difference between player 16 and player 36 is just not sufficiently large to make it that way. So one of the ways that I wanted to think about these guys, and Carter is maybe the most interesting for this conversation, is not whether they're going to fit there because nothing is guaranteed, but like, what do we expect? Like, are they going to reach into that group where, okay, this is a guy that 4 years from now we're going to be comfortable paying, or are they going to be more, is it more likely that they're in the interchangeable section of this conversation?
Yeah, and the number one thing you're looking for when you're talking about one of these guys that you're really going to pay is either, number one, superstar offensive upside. I don't believe that Carter has that. But number two, two-way ability. And there are some good reasons to believe that Carter will have that. I think what I like the most about his offensive game right now is actually the jump shot. He's, in terms of projecting it to the NBA, his didn't shoot a lot of threes, but certainly shot it well from outside when he did. You know, you're always wary of these Duke guys who shoot really well on 41 attempts, but he's over a 40% three-point shooter. But he's been shooting it going back to the lower levels as well. Looks pretty comfortable from outside. Did have kind of some blips in the tournament where he stopped getting comfortable shooting. He had a couple of air balls and then was turning down shots. But certainly for a center at his age, looks very fluid shooting the ball. I project him to get out to being passable from NBA 3 relatively quickly. So that's what he's good offensively. In the post, very skilled, although he does have kind of some odd quirks and limitations, which we'll get to. But as a guy who can get good position, he weighs 251 pounds, 7'4 and a half wingspan, 9'1 standing reach. Even though he's only 6'10, you know, those are totally good numbers for a center. And then when you look defensively, much better rim protector than you might think just kind of looking at him as like a little bit burlier of a guy. He is one of the better bigs that I've seen. He was helped in this somewhat by the fact that he's playing a 2-3 zone a lot of the time at Duke and kind of standing under the rim already. But I thought he did a great job of verticality, one of the better young bigs that I've seen with that. And he really is a quite a quality shot blocker. And I also think he has pretty solid help instincts when he's off the ball. Not quite as good on the ball as when he's in conventional pick and roll defense. But as a help guy, I thought he had pretty good rotations and was very aware. Did that strike you as well?
Yeah, the only thing in his help defense that I didn't love was more on the perimeter with his closeouts. But I think that playing the 2-3 actually hurt him there because he was just too far away.
Right.
And
yeah, like he would have to crash down all the way to like right under the rim. Because he would play on the, you're talking about when he played on the wing on the 2-3, right?
Well, it was both ways. When he was in the center of the 2-3, going out to the perimeter, he was often a step slow, and guys would just beat him. They would catch him. He was a little bit jumpy. They would catch him with a pump fake or something like that. But then when he was on the edge of the 2-3 zone and coming in, he was also usually a step late. But guess what? No NBA teams play a 2-3 zone, so I'm not as concerned about that.
Yeah, I mean, he was going to have help responsibility, but generally, you know, if he has to guard a shooting center, I don't expect him to be amazing at that necessarily. Let's get into his post game a little bit more, which is interesting. I do not expect him to be a guy who's an every down post scorer in the NBA. There are not many of those. There are not many centers who can post up other centers at this point. I think he will be able to get a deep seal with his size. His skill level, I kind of overrated it at first because the first few moves that I saw from him were like these really smooth spins along the baseline. And then I realized as I really got through it, and this is something that he can fix, I'm sure. You know, he has a nice turnaround jumper over his right shoulder, nice spin move over his right shoulder, nice up and under, same side up and under on his right shoulder. And then short range lefty hook over his right shoulder. And then I realized that every move that he makes is over his right shoulder. And in fact, I think over 80% of the time would go right shoulder. And, you know, that's just probably like just a tick. I mean, he's got a good left hand, but I don't really see any reason why he would have to go right shoulder all the time. Usually guys who are right-handed prefer to go left shoulder. So I think he can develop that okay, just for whatever reason. His brain worked that way. He wanted to go baseline a lot more. And he would overcommit to that baseline a lot. When guys played him to go right shoulder, he'd kind of try to go to the pump fake, get him in the air, and then go for the up and under. But if you don't get the guy in the air and you go for the up and under, you just end up having to throw something up. It's kind of a high-risk, high-reward move. I do like the turnaround jumper. I think that that's like an important shot for guys to be able to have. And again, the seals that he would get, good position, played high-low a lot with Duke. He was playing with Bagley. I think he played pretty much every moment that he was on the floor as either the four or the five with another traditional big. He'd play with Bolden a lot, too. That's when he would be on the wing in the two zone.
And DeLaurier.
Yeah.
Yeah. And something that I really liked about Carter, like, he has all these pieces that are intriguing, but I'm not necessarily sure how possession by possession relevant they're going to be. So, like, he's a nice interior passer. He had some plays with Bagley, low, high, low, either direction that I thought were good. Also, he made some really nice passes out when he was basically when he was posting up. Something I really liked about Carter is that he never got tunnel vision. He would see guys in the corner. He would see guys, you know, kind of at different places. And that's a really good thing. That's relevant. He also, like, strangely has a decent two dribble pull up. And so just like, okay, good to know. Nice that you have that in there. I don't really know if that's going to be relevant in the NBA. And so I always had that kind of thing with him. It's like, oh, this is nice. Like, he would pop things for me. Like, I like him better as a trail three guy than a pick and pop guy. I just thought the footwork was a little bit better for him. And, yeah, you know, sometimes NBA teams even can just lose if he's a straight five. They can just lose the center if he's fighting for defensive glass. And that's something else we should talk about with him. We'll do that in a little bit. But I like him better in that capacity. So it's like, okay, that can be useful. It's more of like a one or maybe one and a half possession a game type of thing, but certainly still useful.
Yeah. And you mentioned the passing. I think he can be an effective guy in the DHO game with knowing when to hand off. If the guy goes back door, I trust that he's going to be able to get there to find him. And then also, he's got enough game, you know, attacking off of one or two dribbles, as you alluded to, where, you know, he can go for the fake DHO and then go to the rim. You know, I think he's not quite this level of shooter, but remember, he's only a freshman. Al Horford came out, I think, as a junior. But that's a guy he's been compared to some degree. Now, he doesn't quite have that mobility. That's the biggest thing where he's not quite the same as Al Horford. But I do think there's Al, of course, in the post always has to go left shoulder instead of right shoulder the way Carter is. But I do think there's a little bit of a comparison there in terms of a not the one crazy outstanding skill, but just solid in a lot of areas. You mentioned the role game. Almost never really got to be used as a role man. 20 rolls to the basket, or I'm sorry, 12 possessions rolling to the basket, 12 as a pop man. I mean, again, they just, with Trey Duvall, who couldn't shoot threes at all, playing with another traditional big all the time, there just wasn't the space to run pick and roll. They just ran a lot of other stuff. And that's why how he had so many post-ups and was actually relatively inefficient overall in the post. I don't expect him to be an elite role man. If he's out in space, he can get up for an alley-oop. I mentioned that I compared him to Favors. He's not quite as explosive as a young Derek Favors, but, you know, a higher skill level, certainly.
He's more like Favors now, actually.
Yeah, yeah, that might be accurate. I think that
I actually thought about that a couple times. Yeah,
he did shoot 68% around the basket, and a lot of those were on cuts, on dump-offs. He's not the quickest leaper. When he really loads up, he can get up there. But like one play that I thought was kind of instructive was, you know, a lot of times the footwork, right? Like you'll see a guy who's getting a pass under the rim sort of like take like a little hop as he's catching the ball so he can spring up. And Carter had a play like that. And he really just like he wasn't able to get that quick pop when he has the ball on offense to get up and dunk that. You know, he had to go up for a layup. If he really loads up, he can go up for a dunk pretty well. And also, I think just his ability to shoot with his right and left hand will be important for him finishing around the rim again. I don't think he's going to be an elite role man as either a vertical spacer or a guy who can kind of catch and avoid the defense or go up over people. You know, he's probably going to be a guy at the NBA level who's going to be a little more reliant on getting his shoulder into guys to finish. And then as a pop guy, you know, I think he can get there pick and pop eventually. Whether he can be a pick and pop guy from three, I don't know. I think it's either way. You know, he shot it well from the free throw line, 74%. And for a big with his tools at that age, you know, you have to feel pretty good about it. At the very least, I think you'll feel comfortable if you need to run another set and have, you know, you have a four like an Aaron Gordon or something who wants to roll to the rim. You can put him in the corner. You have something else that you want to do. You want to post up a smaller player. You can put him in the corner and rely on him to hit that at a minimum. Whether he goes beyond that with his three-point shooting, I'm not sure, but I think he has a good chance.
While we're talking about his offense, something else you should mention with Carter is his offensive rebounding. He had a 13% about offensive rebound rate, and I'm happy with that, but also when you consider that Bagley was a very successful offensive rebounder as well, and that he was playing with another big all the time, I think Carter can do that. And something I like with Carter as well is that he's not the best athlete that we will talk about at the five position, but he can get enough that when he goes 100%, he can get down the floor well. So I could see him being a player sort of like what Steven Adams does, where he fights for the fights. Like in the game I watched against Texas, he made Mo Bamba work a lot on the defensive glass, which I really liked. And then he can get back enough that you're not really getting exploited. Now, if he is your only, like if he's your defensive linchpin, there might be some possessions where that trade-off is not worth it. But generally speaking, I think he'll be able to accomplish the offensive rebound and get back relatively well.
Yeah, again, I don't think he's a dominating post scorer, but I think he could be effective against smaller players. I don't think he's a dominating offensive rebounder, but you know, at 251 pounds, I think he could be effective again against smaller players. Is he going to be an unbelievable three-point shooter? I'm not sure, but I think he can be passable out there. Not just like the greatest passer ever, but I think he could be solid. He plays with a high intelligence level, also a high character guy as well. I think he plays hard. You know, I was impressed with his effort level. You mentioned him hitting the offensive glass and then the ability to sprint back. You know, I was really impressed with times when he would go for the offensive board, not get it, and then really just like bust his ass to get back. And he's playing a lot of minutes too. So I thought that his effort level was solid. Let's talk about his defense now. What do you got there?
A couple of different overarching things with Carter. One, I don't love his feet. You know, like there were times, especially you saw that a little bit as a switch defender, but then there were other times where he's kind of help and recover. Or there was a play in the Texas game where Andrew Jones was driving and it was more of a sliding contest. And he just didn't really have it exactly right. He's not bad. Like, certainly this isn't a guy who's like broken in that way, but it was something, and I think he can get better. He talked about how, like, it looks like on the court, like he's working hard. So maybe with good coaching, he can get there. But the biggest thing that I found interesting with him, and I want to see if you, because we don't talk about these, if you saw the same thing, was when I watched a lot of Carter in sequence, it looked to me like he was doing more reading than anticipating what the offensive team was doing, but that he was reading pretty quickly so that it worked in college. And I'm thinking that he will eventually be able to anticipate and just getting into scouting reports and, you know, the coaching is very different in the NBA level. But if he can't transition from reading to anticipating, the athleticism jump and the just massive increase in skill from the college level to the NBA level, that could be a problem. So I think he'll work, but I'm not 100% sure of it.
Yeah, I thought that his help instincts were solid, especially for a freshman big man. I thought there are plays when, you know, if he was off the ball and reacting to a drive, I thought he did well to move early, get over there. There are a lot of plays where, you know, even just showing your body early, you can cause the guy to slow down a little bit and then allow your perimeter defender to get back in front and contest, and then he can go and get a box out. I don't think on the defensive glass he's not a dominating out of area defensive rebounder, but I think, you know, his defensive rebound rate was fine. He was also playing next to Bagley, who chewed up a lot of those defensive rebounds as well, and I think, you know, he could be a solid box out guy who will rebound reasonably well in his area. So again, you know, not a unbelievable defensive rebounder, but I think a solid one, and one who can do a good job keeping other offensive rebounders off the glass so that the rest of the guys on the team can go get those boards. You mentioned I don't really see him as much of a switch guy. They would switch to some degree. He gave up 19 points on 23 possessions in isolation. He had a couple of bad games pretty early in the season. It looked like it got better, but again, only 23 possessions. And then we saw far fewer of those, of course, once they started playing a lot more zone late in the season. And he was playing more as the center in that zone a lot of the time. But I thought he showed a few times where he was able to show quicker feet than expected and move his feet and get in front of a guy and cut him off, but then wasn't able, as we've talked about with a lot of these guys, wasn't able to transition into getting the contest very well. And then other times he would just get totally blown by. And he doesn't really have the quickness, the leaping ability, or, I mean, he has good length, but not just like the quick twitch to really bother a guy from behind once he's beaten. Once he's beaten, he's beaten. He's giving up the layup. He's not really able to contest at that point if he can't actually keep the guy in front of him. So that's, you know, I don't expect him to be an asset as a switch defender. And then in pick and roll, I think he can get better than he has been just to take a little bit better of angles. You know, if he's dropped way back at the rim, I think he could also be useful as a guy who just gets over and contests with verticality, as opposed, it's when he's kind of out at the free throw line where he's not really way out on the floor. You know, they asked him to hedge a lot and then he would sprint back. I thought that looked fine. But when he's kind of in a semi-drop coverage and the guy can get a head of steam and just go right around with the free throw line, I thought that's where he struggled the most. So I'm not sure whether he's going to be. I think he's got hope, especially because of his intelligence and his instincts to really become a better pick and roll defender and take better angles. But he's certainly not there at this point in time.
Yeah, and so I want to just kind of see with a different, not only defensive scheme, but different defensive personnel, how it could work with Carter. And also, we're seeing players with his kind of weaknesses defensively, you know, getting attacked a little bit at the highest levels. But again, most teams aren't at the highest level. You know, we're dealing with a league where maybe there are 10 teams that really need to be concerning themselves with that have a high enough ceiling. And those teams change over time. So you could say if you draft him now, then maybe you'll be that team in 4 years. But yeah, it's interesting. And also something he did a couple of times that I really like from Carter, it's as a kind of a next level thing, is that he would tip a defensive rebound into open space where a teammate could get it. And something I thought about this a little bit, and then I looked it up and was intrigued that I was right, was that Carter measured with very small hands for a center at the combine. His hands were actually smaller than Trevon Duval, Gary Trent Jr., and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Those guys do have a little bit of bigger hands for their position. But there are certain elements of that, as long as he's a good rebounder, fights for positioning, that aren't necessarily a downside. There's been this theory out there that part of the reason big guys struggle shooting free throws is
because... Yeah, I think that theory is bullshit.
I think that theory is bullshit too, but I don't know. There's just kind of something about him where I'm just sitting there going like, I like everything, but I don't love anything. And I don't know why the hand thing kind of stuck out to me is a little bit of that. Also, we should mention 74% shooting from the free throw line.
Yeah.
That bodes well for his shooting. And so some of the other top line numbers, cause I just want to make sure we go through those while we have them. 63% true shooting, 23% usage, 7.6 block rate. And I mentioned the 13 offensive rebound, 23 defensive rebound, which when you consider the surrounding talent, I'm happy with that. I don't love it, but I'm happy with it. So I don't know if there's any more kind of the nuts and bolts, but I'll get into some of them because we can use it to talk about this. I like Wendell Carter a lot, but I have this idea of him with the kind of overall production versus value concept of this, where he might be I haven't watched them yet. He might be a better player than the Bridges, Mikal Bridges and Miles Bridges. But the odds that even if there's a very significant chance to me that he is a better player than them, but less valuable than those guys just because of positional scarcity.
Yeah. And we'll see whether, I mean, I haven't watched a single minute of either of those guys yet, and we may not have a chance to do much of it before the draft, but, I agree with you there. You know, now identifying whether those guys or Kevin Knox or whatever are going to be better than Carter, tough to say. I wanted to talk also about his ability to protect the rim. I mentioned the verticality, but he also blocks a lot of shots. He had a 7.5% two-point block rate and really good timing. His post defense, I thought, was pretty impressive. He only gave up 22 points on 54 possessions when he's being posted up. I mean, that's just an incredible number. And he had this ability, I think partially because he just has such a big body, but also he just has really quick timing with his hands. And he would like either almost block or like get very close to blocking and throw off guys, even just shooting jump hooks. And like, he just got a lot of blocks just one-on-one defending in the post, which, you know, for, again, it's like you want to think that he's kind of this big body, ground bound, you know, Alan Williams type of guy. But he really shows flashes of athleticism beyond that. And same thing with blocking shots. He doesn't get off the ground that high on defense, but he gets off the ground really quickly. And so I think that can kind of surprise guys, and his timing is really outstanding. So I agree with you. You know, it's tough for me. I always like to go with the guys in the top 10 that I believe to have superstar upside. It's hard to find that with Carter. I mean, he does have a really nice skill level in the post, and perhaps he could just become such a good post scorer, but he's a little bit undersized as far as being a dominating post scorer that I don't think he can quite get there if you're just going to throw the ball to him in the post. And then, you know, he would have to be a player along the lines, again, of an Al Horford type, just to do everything, but he just can't quite do enough defensively with me in terms of his ability to move his feet. If he could just do that a little bit more, then I would be like really high on him, I think, in terms of his versatility. But because I don't think he quite has the defensive versatility that is needed to be an elite defensive center in today's game, you know, I can't quite be as high on him as I wanted to really be a little bit higher on him. But just in terms of not having that one skill, but also just having a couple of weaknesses that just don't, you know, whether it's getting up for alley-oops as a role man on offense, whether it's moving his feet defensively, I can't quite get around the idea that this is a guy who has star upside, even if you're talking about a star as, like, you know, more of a do-everything Al Horford type than, you know, this 28% usage, like, scoring superstar type of guy.
And it just kind of... It sucks in a sense because he does so much that I like that the threshold for me
is really like
not into the star category.
I really like his game.
Yeah, I do too. Like, and he doesn't have to be a star to be really valuable. There's a kind of that 10 to 15 range we talked about with centers that, you know, they can provide a lot. I think Andre Drummond might end up in that area as well. So I don't think the Pistons are sad that they took Andre Drummond at all. Not in the slightest. I mean, maybe compared to what he was that rookie season, you know, with the way Drummond worked out. And I'm not comparing these two guys at all, because they're very different types of centers. But yeah, it's hard with Carter, because there is that to like, and it's again also the weirdness of this draft class that there are things that are more valuable, but those players just don't exist that we've seen so far. So that's a little bit of a challenge. So I also would be very interested in, you know, stuff like if he had that in terms of what the Duke coaching staff said about his work ethic and like working on his skill development, because you could see a lot of that. But maybe like, and I'm like, oh, there's a lot to like. Maybe if he could, you know, get a more reliable footwork on a pick and pop three, or, you know, one of those elements. But at the same point, what's holding him back from that real high upside is not his skill level, because his skill level is better than damn near any guy I've seen his age, you know, at his position.
Yeah, no, it's especially when you consider his ability to shoot it. And he seems like a good kid. He seems like a smart player. One of the criticisms is that he's almost like kind of too smart and too cerebral at times.
Oh, actually, there's one other thing I wanted to talk about. So you mentioned it before, but I think we need to put a finer point on it. He does so much of the, I talked about this with Ayton and in the opposite context, and I enjoyed kind of thinking about those two guys together, that Carter is so much more consistent at doing the like kind of little movements and battles that are a part of the center position. And I think that he will be one of those players that other centers don't like playing against, which is a good compliment for him. But I don't know that he's going, like, especially on the, you know, on the glass, where it's just be like, he's just getting in there. He's not the best screen setter, but he's better than a lot of these other guys because he actually cares, which is a pretty big differentiator between him and like Bagley, let's say, as a screener. So you kind of sit there and go, okay, well, that's a good thing to have. This is all, we're all happy with this. And so you sit there, like, I could totally see him succeeding. Like, it's so weird to be low on somebody who I like this much.
Yeah, but that is the nature of the center position at this time. And that's why I thought the way you wanted to bring this in, and he may end up being a guy who gets paid. You know, you could see him maybe being the 10th best center in the NBA if things work out for him. Or maybe, you know, maybe there's some possibility he could improve his lateral mobility. He doesn't look heavy or anything, so I'm not, you know, he's already listed, although these body fat measurements are very suspect in terms of the range of error for any particular measurement. But at the combine, 7.5% body fat, that's like totally good for 250-pound guy who's 6'10". But I think that's just the nature of the center position ultimately. And I think he can be a solid starter, but that's just, you know, and also I think the other part of it to me too is I'm starting to like this draft more and more the more we go through it. And, you know, if you were to compare him to, say, like Zach Collins last year, I'm like, oh man, I'd much rather have Wendell Carter than Zach Collins, you know, at this point. And he went number 10 last year, though he was kind of out of the top tier of guys. I will say this, though, I don't think I haven't finished the whole board yet. We'll talk about that once we're done with as many of these as we're going to do. But to me, he's projected to go number 6 right now, Trae Young 7, Michael Porter 8. Him being above either of those guys, unless Porter's body is just, it's determined that his body is just broken, that just makes no sense. Like, I think those guys have just so much more upside than Carter. Like, it would not make sense to me to take Carter above them.
We are in agreement there. And yeah, I mean, it's such a different class. But yeah, I like a lot of these guys too. And I've seen, you know, some of them by watching. I enjoyed that Carter played against both Bamba and Jaren Jackson. And I kind of got a sense of kind of how that's all going to work. And yeah, I like him a lot. And yeah, but you compare this to last year's class. I mean, so actually this was something I thought would be a good little exercise for us to do. We were talking about centers. So here are some guys kind of in that range. Some of these guys are going to be above that kind of 15 threshold, and some guys are probably going to be a little bit below, but I thought this would be a good kind of thought exercise. So like, I wouldn't expect in terms of overall impact for Carter to be better than Clint Capela, would you?
Yeah, Capella's story remains to be written here. But
sure.
No, I mean, the way that he was like outplaying like Rudy Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns, not that he's necessarily better than those guys. You know, I don't see how Carter could get to that type of, he just gets so much better moving his feet.
What about Miles Turner?
Yeah, it really depends how you value Turner's defense. You know, I think Turner is probably going to be a better shooter ultimately than Carter, but you know, Carter probably had a better shooting season than Turner did as a freshman. But Turner, I think, just especially with that high and quick release. So, you know, maybe he could be in that range, possibly.
And then the last one I want to mention, this is going to be an example of why giving centers long-term money is a challenge. Valanciunas, another guy who's probably close to properly paid. I think I'm right now, like, I would expect that I will like Carter better 4 years from now than I like Valanciunas right now.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, I mean, just for perspective, this was, I think, my personal rankings here. And we did this back in the middle of the season, so I'd probably change it at this point. But I had, these are my tier four centers. Steven Adams, DeAndre Jordan, Clint Capela, Marc Gasol were 8 through 11 for me in the league. And I don't see Carter quite getting into that range. I could see him being right below there, where we had Hassan Whiteside, who would be lower now, obviously. Derek Favors, Pau Gasol, Miles Turner. That was like 12 through 15. That's kind of the range I see him falling into if things go about how we would expect them to for him. And that's a valuable player. You know, that's when you're in the lower end of the top 10, getting a guy like that who's a solid starter, you know, you got to feel pretty good about that. It's just a question of, there's some guys who really have some upside in this draft, and I think, you know, you taking him over them would not be something that I would want to.
Also worth noting that I think that range of player is about right, that there are, by where I think we're going to end up with him, there are three centers above him in this class. So you think about how that could age out too, that maybe those lines get a little bit, those tiers get a little bit thicker.
Well, I also have a prediction for you that he will be better than at least one of those guys.
Oh,
one
absolutely.
Of those guys
I wouldn't be surprised by that at all.
Kind of flame out.
Sure. Absolutely fair.
All right. That's enough for today. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow to wrap up the week. I want to thank Sonos for sponsoring today's program. With Father's Day coming up, Sonos and Spotify have got you covered. Go to fathersday.sonos.com to get a code for 15% off. When you create a custom Spotify playlist to send to your dad, simply select your favorite artist and the year you were born, then do the same for your dad. Spotify will then generate the perfect playlist to bridge the generation gap. Go to fathersday.sonos.com. You can get that massive 15% off. It's one of the best deals that they've had in quite some time. Fathersday.sonos.com. Playlist generator expires June 17th. Terms and conditions apply.